This is Box Score, brought to you by Games Radar. I'm your host, Richard Grisham. When you have the chance to sit down and talk with someone like ESPN's Gus Ramsey, it's easy to go in about a thousand different directions. After all, he's someone who's passionate about many things, ranging from his family to his career to sports and video games, and they all tie together in many ways. So despite my preparation for a show focused specifically on a review of MLB 12, the show, with a tight outline and a specific series of questions, and because Gus is just genuinely a great guy, we wound up talking for close to 2 hours on a broad range of sports and game-related subjects. It was so much fun, I split the whole conversation into two podcasts. This is part one, where we spend some time talking about his relatively new role at ESPN Sports Nation, his beloved Denver Broncos, the whole Peyton Manning Tim Tebow saga, as well as some old-school Major League Baseball. We eventually get to MLB 12, the show, but you'll have to head to part two for that. So here's part one of a two-part Box Score interview with Gus Ramsey. All right, we're here with the great Gus Ramsey from ESPN Sports Nation. Many of you probably know him from his epic calls on the Bill Simmons podcast, the BS Report, as well as on the podcast that he's on with ESPN, and also his GusRamsey.blogspot.com blog, as well as the Twitter at Gus Ramsey. So Gus is making a lot of use of the various social devices. Mr. Ramsey, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Wow, that almost sounded like I have a resume to tout. Thanks, I appreciate that.
You do have quite the resume. A lot of followers, and I just actually, earlier today, read your season preview of the Mets, and we're recording this on a Saturday night of the opening week of baseball, and I figured no better time than sort of the kickoff of the baseball season, bad pun there, to talk a lot about baseball, a lot about MLB, the show in particular, talk a little bit about Gus and my favorite team, the Mets, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff. So, but before we get too much into the show, which is kind of the focus of the podcast today, I did want to talk a little bit about Gus's latest endeavor at ESPN. Now, you have relatively recently joined the Sports Nation show.
That is correct.
And so maybe you could talk a little bit about how that's going, because it sure seems like you're enjoying it.
Yeah, it's just really different from anything I've done in my 17-plus years at ESPN, which mostly consisted of SportsCenter and Baseball Tonight and Baseball Tonight-like shows, NBA Tonight, College Hoops Tonight, whatever, where you know, the focus of those shows is highlights and hard news and reaction to them, and you know, Sports Nation, we talked about the news of the day, but in a different, more fun, somewhat goofy kind of way. So I really kind of have to turn off my journalist mind and kind of adapt to you know, a different way of thinking, which is funny. It's weird for me in that, you know, everybody at work who knows me knows that's you know, more my cup of tea. My stock line for the last 2 months has been I was pretending to be a journalist for 17 years, and now I'm ready to go to work. And on the day that the big NFL day, when the Saints suspensions or the bounty story came out and Tim Tebow went to the Jets, you know, my natural inclination was, what are the right questions that we need to be asking and talking about? And that was the absolute wrong way to think. My first thought should have been, what questions should we be asking that won't be asked on SportsCenter and, more importantly, on Around the Horn and PTI, which are the shows that we're up against? You know, so that's kind of the tact of the show, besides, you know, all the poll questions that we do and the back and forth between Colin and Michelle. It's really, you know, one of the questions we probably should ask that day is, the Jets now have the hottest quarterback tandem in the league with Tim Tebow and Mark Sanchez. I mean, you want to talk about two good-looking poster boys.
Okay. You're using, you know, hot in a different context.
Yeah.
There. Okay.
No, hot in the terms of two hunky guys.
Right.
You know, like, that's a question we probably should have asked. It's a lot of fun. We were involved in the release of the cover vote for Madden,
sure,
13, and recently we had in Darrell Revis and Rob Gronkowski, who were who had advanced into the next round at the time that they were in Bristol, and we did a segment with Gronk called "Will It Break," where we just had him spike stuff. And beforehand, Darrell and Colin Coward debated whether or not they thought it was actually going to break or not. And then Gronk spiked it, and we would see if it would break. And we had four meetings that day talking about, you know, some of it was legitimate, like, we only have two cameras today, so how are we going to make this work? Where do we want them to stand? What's the – you're really mapping out the whole bit. But part of the discussion was, well, what are we going to have them break? Or attempts to break, you know, and I can tell you that in my years at SportsCenter, it was always kind of like, all right, we got this guy, he's here, let's ask him this question, maybe we do this one funny thing and we move on, and that was it. You know, we'd never have four meetings about, should we do watermelon or pineapple, you know. my original last item was, we opened with a half gallon of milk, which, believe it or not, we actually debated whether or not that was going to break, and Gronk soon made us all look like idiots by obliterating the gallon. It was fantastic. I said I want to open with the milk because it's going to be the most visually spectacular if it goes, and it did. It was like a bomb going off. This milk flew everywhere. It was great. And then we debated watermelon or pineapple. We thought pineapple's got a harder outer edge and a thicker core, so maybe not, but of course he obliterated that. And then my original last choice was going to be bowling ball, and you know, we found a bowling ball, and I just thought it was like a great kind of Gronk spike rock, you know. And if it broke, it was going to be a monumental thing. It was going to be all over the internet. Gronk broke a bowling ball, you know. But we decided, we were afraid that perhaps a piece might fly off and do some damage to somebody looking on. And really, worst case scenario was, you're not going to stick your fingers in the holes to spike it. So you have to kind of hold it in your palm. And God forbid he lose control of it as he's going to spike it. You know, and he killed our cameraman who was standing in front of him or something. Yeah. That would be bad.
Yes, indeed.
So then the next choice was going to be an iPad with, like, a Colin screensaver on it, and he was going to act like it was his iPad.
Very nice.
And then we thought, you know what, people might not appreciate the fact that we're breaking brand-new iPads when they would love to have one.
True.
So we opted for just a trophy, with the hook being that it was Colin's world's greatest dad trophy, and that there was some sentimental attachment. But that was a lot of fun, and those are the kind of things we do. And Colin and Michelle are great; they have great chemistry, and it's a great group of people. You know, we have a lot of fun, and it's as much as I enjoyed all my time on the serious shows to, you know, kind of ignore the Penn State type stories or the Syracuse type stories, and you can just kind of focus on the lighter heart of sports. You know, it was a little bit of a relief after 17 years. So,
you know, it's interesting. This is the second time that we've spoken, and one of the things that I've really come to realize is that, no, I mean, obviously we're the same general age range, but we have a lot of different similarities. And I recently made a career change a little more than a year ago. From I work in the software world, and I used to be the guy who was implementing the software at different companies, you know, and that's a hard gig. You know, you got to make sure everything works right. If issues come up, you know, on a Friday night or a Sunday morning, it doesn't matter. You got to fix them. But I made a switch to more of the sales side, really more of an engineering perspective. And looking back, I'm like, man, this is so much more forward thinking. It's a little more entertaining. There's a whole different set of problems, but the problems aren't as, you know, sort of at the moment that they happen. So nowadays I'm like, man, I don't think I could ever go back to doing really what I used to do for 15 years. So doing what you're doing now, do you have that kind of that pang to go back to the more serious stuff? Or are you kind of like me, or is like, boy, I really kind of like this. I don't foresee myself going back to what I used to do.
Yeah, I mean, I always say, if someone had ever told me you can only do one thing in your time in ESPN, you know, then I would have continued to be the coordinating producer of Baseball Tonight. I had the privilege to do that for 7 years.
Sure.
And we'd go to the World Series, and we'd go to the All-Star Game every year, and it's a great group of guys, and baseball is my first love. And I always say the best thing about that show, and similarly an NFL show or an NBA show is everybody who works on the show is there because, first and foremost, because they love baseball.
Right.
And the TV part of it is almost the second part. So you walk into those show meetings, and it's just a great creative process, and everybody's kind of in it together, and so that's a lot of fun. My most recent tour of SportsCenter was my second. I did SportsCenter when I first got there in the mid-90s, and then in 2000 I went to Baseball Tonight. And, you know, so for me, I did the last year and a half of Dan and Keith on the 11 o'clock SportsCenter. I worked with Craig Kilborn on the overnight SportsCenter, and that was just a different time. So to come back to it now in 2010, when the show was 3 hours long, and it's just a different kind of animal now. We have so many more elements that we put into the SportsCenter day in and day out, that even though it was now a 3-hour show instead of an hour show, in a lot of ways there was less room for the creativity. And obviously it just makes for a longer day when you're in the control room 3 times longer than you used to be.
Sure.
So for me, it had lost a little of the panache only because I had done it before and I really liked it back then. I love the group of people that I worked with this time around. It just, the day in, day out kind of grind wasn't necessarily for me. So I would go back to the more serious stuff if it was a Baseball Tonight type thing.
Right.
But usually at ESPN, you get at least good 2 years on an assignment. So right now I'm just focusing on making the most out of Sports Nation and trying to improve those ratings and make that show fun and keep that show evolving.
And, you know, it's interesting, too. The world is changing so quickly. ESPN is at the forefront of it. ESPN has, you know, they watch ESPN on the apps, you know, on iPads and mobile devices. It's got, you know, the 360 where you can watch on a computer. It's on my Xbox 360. Does that impact you, you know, as a longtime guy? Are the things that you do on a daily basis impacted by sort of the new different ways that ESPN programming is distributed? Or is that really the technical aspect and what you do on a regular basis isn't impacted by all that?
Yeah, I think the only real impact on those who work in studio is you're mindful of it, and it used to be, you know, the 11 o'clock Sports Center. We're on at 11, we're off at midnight, and off to Jupiter it goes. But now, you know, all these shows kind of live somewhere, some way beyond when you do it. So you're a little mindful of that. We will always say you never produce for the re-air. If this show is re-airing, that's not the purpose of why we're doing it. We're producing it for the live audience, but you need to be mindful of, we just did Sports Nation, but it's slated to run again at 1 a.m. on ESPN2. So we did all this Dwight Howard talk today. If he gets traded tonight, you know, someone should probably be alerted so they could pull that re-air and run World's Strongest Man or whatever it is, you know, we run in those situations. But
right.
It's not necessarily on the forefront of your thinking, but you're just a little more mindful that it's out there in a lot of different ways. And a lot of times that manifests itself in promotional stuff. It's like you want to drive people. On Sports Nation, we have a great internet component with Facebook and YouTube. And so a lot of stuff we'll do is remind people that, hey, you can get more of this on our Facebook page. Kind of stuff. You know, Twitter clearly has smashed its way into everybody's broadcast now. It's almost impossible to watch any kind of a live news show without some kind of a Twitter element to it, whether it's a hashtag or something, just drive people to take part either through Twitter or to raise awareness of your show. I mean, last year on SportsCenter, I said it was the Tuesday after, or it was the day after the All-Star game, where typically nothing is going on in the sports world. And I said, I want to do the two to three hour of SportsCenter as a Twitter show. And just let's get into the topic. Let's talk to people about how Twitter has impacted the sports world and whatnot. And, you know, we're on for 3 hours. There's no problem in taking one of those hours to delve into that. And, you know, for a while, I forget what our hashtag was that day, but SportsCenter Twitter or whatever it was it was the number two trending topic on Twitter for a while. And that's beneficial in two ways. One, it draws awareness to the show, and you hope that in then turns brings people's eyeballs to your show. But, you know, early research indicates right now that Twitter traffic doesn't necessarily raise your ratings. I think you can gain slight increments. But a lot of times people are just commenting on whatever's being discussed on Twitter. That doesn't make them then grab their remote and change over to whatever show it is. I think a lot of it is people just go, oh, yes. All right, so SportsCenter's talking about Twitter. I think Twitter's great, and thanks. But it doesn't necessarily make them go, oh, I got to turn on SportsCenter now because they're talking about Twitter. The most interesting thing that came out of that day was we had Adam Schefter and Buster Olneon both commenting on how Twitter has changed the way they do their jobs and how, you know, deadlines don't even exist anymore. And it's that race to be first and the race to be right. And how they have now that information is at their fingertips. But that's an interesting dynamic, too, because you say, well, all right, so Buster Olneon, I don't even know how many followers he has. Let's say he's got 750,000 followers. Well, that's still smaller than the average SportsCenter audience. You know, so it's still more important for Buster to get the news out to the SportsCenter audience than it is to his Twitter audience. And sometimes they're simultaneous, and sometimes they're relatively close. But, you know, we still want to service the TV audience first. But that, you know, 6 months from now, it could be different.
Right. It's amazing. You know, it's funny, too, because in a relatively short amount of time, Twitter has become, you know, the Twitter app on my phone and on my iPad has become the way that I can just quickly glance around the world. Not only, like, if I want to know what's going on in sports, I type ESPN.com, hit the enter button, and there I am. If I want to get a quick view as to what's going on in the world, I type CNN.com. But if I want to see what's going on within the different circle of people that I follow, and I follow writers, you know, sports writers, I follow musicians, I follow games writers and journalists, I follow sort of this whole potpourri, it's interesting how if I just want to get a sense for what's really happening in the sort of the global world, I just go to my Twitter feed and I can instantly see what people are talking about. And you know, 2 years ago, even, you know, Twitter was around, but it wasn't what it is now. It's just so interesting how that has evolved and permeated every aspect of our lives, from sports to music to politics and everything in between. It's amazing.
Yeah, I, for me, the primary benefits are twofold. One, I love it just from an informational standpoint. When you follow the right people who have good information, it really is just kind of like having the news, weather, sports, whatever, at your fingertips. Like, oh, that just happened. Oh, this just happened. And then when there's a major event going on that almost everybody is watching, it's a great source of entertainment and humor, and you know, it enhances the watching experience of whether it's the national championship game or the Oscars or whatever it is, when everybody's kind of in on it together and the jokes are going back and forth or just the reaction to an amazing play, it makes the viewing experience better.
It's great to hear what people you like, both your friends as well as people you know of, you know, celebrities, sort of almost be having the same conversation about a big game or a big event. And that you know, how you see them all kind of next to each other. You know, one of my friends who might have 200 followers, and then the person right behind him is Bill Simmons, who's got a million followers, and then Gus Ramsey will pipe in with something, and then the next thing I know, I've just got all these different people talking about the same topic, and yet none of them are connected, but they're all on my feed. It's just such a great way to, it's a great way to experience something, but it's also a great way to still have the importance of live television, I think, or live events, because so many, I mean, I don't watch really anything live anymore except sports, you know, the occasional event like the Oscars or something like that, but really sports is the only thing I watch live anymore, and like you say, Twitter is just another way to experience that and get somebody else's perspective on something that I wouldn't normally catch.
It's also all but eliminated original thought. I mean that from the standpoint that I can tweet something and think like, hey, that was clever, I just thought of that, and put it out there, and then you find out someone else. You know, you get three responses like, I just tweeted the exact same thing.
Yep.
You know, you're not quite as clever as you think you are, or funny as you think you are. Occasionally you hit one and you get a bunch of retweets, and for those 8 seconds people think you're funny. But, you know, as a guy who's, I've always kind of prided myself on being quick-witted and having the quick one-liner, and, you know, it diminishes that pretty quick. And then there was one time last year, I had never seen Happy Gilmore. People refused to believe the fact that I had never seen Happy Gilmore. But I made some joke about someone had been in the sand trap a bunch of times, and I made the he's been on the beach more than Hasselhoff joke. And I thought it was an original joke, and I got killed by people like, oh, now you're stealing Adam Sandler's lines. And I said, folks, I've never seen Happy Gilmore. And I was like, oh, sure, you've never seen it. Like one of those, you can't win. So, but it's the interaction is fun. And one thing I've always sworn, and I, you know, obviously I work with people who are much more high profile and have many more followers than I do, but I say, you know, always take the high road. You know, people like to use Twitter as a reason to call you names or to say you're an idiot or just to argue with you for the sake of arguing.
Right.
There's no good in going back at somebody. I just always say, thank you for your opinion. Have a nice day. I'm not even a religious guy, but I'll throw in the God bless you just to make people feel guilty. You know, and then if it gets too bad, the block is the greatest invention ever. It's, if there was a way to take blocking and add it into your daily life, that would be awesome. In your personal interactions, but overall, I had abstained from Twitter for a long time until Simmons kept badgering me to get in it, and for the most part, I'm glad that I have.
Well, you know, it is funny, too, because so many people do attack others directly on Twitter. I mean, one of the many people I follow is Peter King, and he's really good at retweeting some of the Buster Olney does it too, I believe. I mean, a lot of the guys do it, but Buster and Peter King in particular will retweet. And I'm constantly shocked at how these, you know, Twitter handles, these guys will just call people idiots or even worse things. And you know, it's basically like walking up to somebody and tying them to their face and then smacking them in their face. I'm constantly shocked at how many people do that and how brazen they are about it.
There was a gentleman, I forget his name, he's an author in the New York Mets, he was a Mets beat writer for a while. He wrote the book, The Bad Guys Won, about the 86 team.
Yes, I have that book.
Right, I forget his name. But he did a piece where he basically went to the homes of three people who said nasty things to him on Twitter.
Jeff Perlman.
Yes. And he just like showed up at the door and said, hi. I was curious, why did you say that to me? You know, and one guy like still lived with his mom, and his mom was outraged at her son for doing that to him. And, you know, most they all admitted, I was just trying to get a rise out of you, you know, and that's half of it. And I usually kind of assume that that's part of it too. And then I look and I say, all right, well, this person has two followers and is following six people. So maybe I look at their timeline and go, all right, clearly this person, all he wants to do is aggravate people. So I'll just block them and I'll move on with my life.
You know, the other thing another thing that just consistently confuses me on Twitter is I'll get excited, I'll get a follower, and then I'll realize it's Janie X0457. Yeah. It's some bot. I'm still trying to figure out what the point of these bots is, how, you know, why they exist and what they're doing. I probably have, you know, at least one third of my quote unquote followers are actually these weird bots that I don't know why they exist or what they do.
Yeah, no, I when I see something that doesn't look like my demographic, I will click on them just to see what they've tweeted. And once I see that, all right, this is just someone who's out there doing promotional stuff or whatever, then I just automatically block them and move on.
You mentioned something about Sports Nation and the Madden cover vote. I'm actually going to the Tiburon Studios next week to get a preview of Madden 13. And a couple weeks after that, I'll be in New York City for the unveiling of the cover vote with, I believe, some of the Sports Nation crew. I'll be covering that.
I believe, I might be there myself. So.
Fantastic. So hopefully we can, I'm sure you'll be busy, but hopefully we can at least say hello.
Yeah, but, that's going to be on, I think it's the 25th?
Yeah, it's the day before the draft, I believe.
Wednesday the 25th, yeah. I think, that day, yeah.
I am amazed at how big the cover vote has become. When I was interviewing one of the marketing directors from Madden a few weeks ago for a column I wrote, they said that basically the amount of traffic that the site had generated was more than really anything that ESPN and EA had ever experienced. From your perspective, sort of leading the charge or being in the forefront of that cover vote, how has that been, and what's your, you know, sort of, you know, what's your observation as to how that's all unfolded over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I will say that the bulk of that comes from the .com side of it, not too much with the TV, but just being privy to some of the conversations. I think they did more traffic this year than they had anticipated. It went exceedingly well. So it's interesting just the fact that, you know, not only do people care about it, but they care about it in a serious way. Like I was stunned Tim Tebow lost in the first round. I thought, well, he's extremely popular and he's extremely unpopular. And so people will vote to, you would think they would have voted for him so that he'd get on the cover and then suffer a Madden curse, or people would vote for him because they love him. Right. I thought there was no way this guy's going to win. But if you take it strictly from who's the best football player, then yes, Arian Foster, the 3 seed, should have beaten Tim Tebow, the 11 seed, and he did. You know, now I think it will, at some point, it trickles down to a bit of a popularity contest. Obviously, you know, last year with Peyton Hillis was kind of bizarre, but he also had a great year the year right before. But if I remember, did he beat Julian Edelman, I think? Or was it Welker? It was Wes Welker, I think, was who we beat. You know, great player, but also a pretty popular player. So there's clearly a mix there. But that online dynamic is, you know, if you had told someone 5 years ago, oh, yeah, we're going to be doing a bracket every year and the fans are going to vote for the cover of Madden, I'm like, all right, enjoy those 782 hits you're going to get on your website.
Yeah, it is massively popular. And what's recently happened now, NHL 13 now has their own cover vote. The NCAA game has a cover vote coming out, so they've quickly kind of seized upon it and are using it as a way to involve their communities for all of their games, they being EA Sports in this case. So one last thing before then we get to MLB The Show. You've had some time to ruminate on it. Tim Tebow is no longer a Bronco. Peyton Manning is a Bronco. You were, let's just say, more than a little happy the day that it happened. I listened to the BS report when he had you on specifically, and I believe you were running around giving high fives and, you know, mentioned people were congratulating you. So
yep, took a victory lap.
So you've had some time now. Yeah. Where do you stand on Tebow leaving, Manning coming in, and the overall Broncos quarterback situation?
I will say that mostly I wish that there would have been a way for Tebow to stick around. And I honestly think that, you know, spending a little time behind Peyton Manning and still being counseled by John Elway would have made him a better player. But I understand, A, the Broncos couldn't keep him around, and B, you know, he wants to go compete to be a starting quarterback. So
right.
Good for him. Part of me is happy that he's a Jet. At least he's in my area, and I'll still be able to see him play a lot.
Sure.
You know, but it was a no-brainer of no-brainers, and it was the one scenario where Elway could get out from under Tebow mania. It was the one chance he had, was get Peyton Manning to come in, and the majority of Bronco fans would be like, oh, great. Hey, Tim, thanks, but we're going to have to ask you to leave now.
Yep.
You know, and you know, time will tell if he's healthy and if he can withstand hits and all that. And, you know, they still have a brutal schedule. They still might be a 9 or 10 win team next year. But clearly their chances, I think, are better. It was just such a weird dynamic. I don't think anyone doesn't doubt that when they were 1-4, Elway kind of threw Tebow out there and said, fine, here you go.
Right.
This is what you want. Expecting what happened in the Detroit game. But he won the first game. And then after the Detroit game, they said, all right, well, what's working and what's not working? And then it really was almost like Major League, where they weird things started happening. And they kept, you know, guys are running out of bounds or fumbling, and the kicker's making 84-yard field goals. And
you know,
part of Elway was like, oh, come on already. You know, I don't doubt for a second that John Elway wants the Broncos to win every game they play. But I also don't doubt that part of him was like, this is not what I was expecting.
Yep.
You know, he expected two or three stink bombs and go, all right, there, you happy now? Because they watched the man practice every day. And by all accounts, he's completing about 50% of his passes to unguarded receivers in practice.
Right.
Now, which is why Mark Sanchez should be thrilled. There's no way Tim Tebow is going to go into camp and outperform Mark Sanchez in practice situations. It's not going to happen. But I think, obviously, he's a great guy. He's great to have on in your franchise and to be representing your franchise. And I still think, for a little while anyway, the guy's going to find a way to be a competent, competitive NFL player. And Broncos fans will always be grateful for the amazing wins he gave us and a playoff win for the ages. I mean, that's going to be, you know, 20 years from now when you're putting together the Broncos' greatest hits moments, that's going to be there, and I'm going to get goosebumps every time I see it.
Had this the prior Broncos regime still been running the team, do you think they would have made the same move, or do you think Elway, being the consummate quarterback, really this had his fingerprints on it more than anything else, making the move?
Yeah, no, I mean, you mean if Josh McDaniels was still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they would have been fully committed to Tebow, and McDaniels would have done everything in his power to convince Bolin that we're fine, this is the way to go. You don't want to spend all this money on a 35-year-old quarterback coming off of neck surgeries. And no, as I said to Bill, I just really think Elway, you know, he had it in his mind, here's what a quarterback is.
Right.
And when he looks at Tim Tebow, he says, that's not what a quarterback is. And maybe he won some games, but I know for the long haul, this is not the answer. And, oh, by the way, I can bring in a guy who is what a quarterback is. That's what I need to do.
And are you happy with Elway running the franchise? I mean, not a whole lot of guys make the move from legendary Hall of Fame player to successful general manager or vice president of operations or whatever his specific title is. Are you happy? Are you confident that Elway is the right guy to run the team?
Yeah, well, start with last year. They had a great draft. A really productive draft. And it's funny, and you know, I'm not speaking from a great wealth of knowledge here, but it seems to me like that's much more the case in basketball and to a slighter degree baseball, but it doesn't come up a whole lot in the NFL. I mean, Matt Millen's the first guy that comes to mind who, all right, he didn't do. But Ozzie Newsome's done a great job.
True.
You know, and now here's Elway. But for the most part, I can't think of a lot of examples where you could make that comparison. I mean, the NBA is wrought with them.
Sure.
Baseball's had some, but unless they're just people I'm not thinking of, it doesn't seem like it comes up that often in the NFL. I just think in the NFL, guys who played the game might be the better talent evaluators. You know, clearly that's not the case in the NBA. Michael Jordan, Larry Bird's done okay, but not great. Magic, okay, not great.
Joe Dumars won a couple of titles, so one example.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of hit and miss, but in the NFL, I think John Elway knows what makes for a good football player, and his dad was a coach. I think he knows what it takes to win in the league. And I'm always encouraged. It's kind of like when I watch the Mets broadcast and Keith Hernandez talks about the importance of pitching.
Right.
You know, he knows. It's not just a guy who goes, no, just hit the heck out of the ball and you'll win games. No, that's not how it works. And John Elway knows you got to be able to run the ball and we got to be able to stop teams on defense. And he gets that. So I have total confidence in
him. One of my favorite stories you talked about is the Micro League Baseball. It's one of my all-time favorite games. In fact, there's a new game out on the iPad. I don't know if you have an iPad or not. It's called Out of the Park Baseball, which is got a lot of Micro League in it. So for $5, it's recommended. I actually just picked it up a couple days ago. I've been having fun with it. Micro league baseball back in the day, back in the 80s, was, you know, one of the greatest things ever, frankly. And I spent days and weeks and months playing the game, having seasons, doing all sorts of stuff. There's a story about you and Bill Simmons creating a micro league season and then sort of how it got put together and then how it ended and all that. I would love for the listeners to hear this story.
Well, this was, I want to say it was summer of 88. It was before my last year in college. And my folks had just moved out to California that year. And I was I'm one of six kids, but I was the only one still in Connecticut at the time. So I was living with like a friend of my mom's family for that summer. So for the most part, I was spending all my non-working hours at Bill's house. And he had micro league baseball. Now, growing up, I was a big Stratomatic fan.
Sure.
And in some ways, micro league was the first kind of video evolution of Stratomatic. I used to sit there and play Stratomatic and score the games and have box scores and do the stats and all that. But now, instead of rolling the dice, you just had to press a couple keys on the keyboard. And Bill had the version of the game that would give you the box scores and track statistics, and you know, he had a printer for his computer, which, you know, in the 80s was a big deal. And,
absolutely.
You know, the thing was like the size of a Hyundai, and but it was right there next to his computer. So we decided that summer that we were going to play a 162-game season, and I made a roster of the greatest Mets of all time, and he had made a roster of the greatest Red Sox of all time from 1962 on. So we were working on an even playing field. So no Ted Williams for him and some of those guys.
Okay.
So pretty much every day over the course of the summer, you know, we'd get together and play one game or two games. You know, we would have to hold up something to cover our eyes when the other guy was making his pitch selection, you know, because you didn't want anything nefarious going on. Every once in a while, you'd be like, you looked, I know. How else would you know I was going to throw a slider on 3-0 or whatever?
It sounds like none of these games were simulated. You played them all head-to-head.
Played every single one.
That's great.
And there's two good parts of this story. One of which is that was also the summer that I had the fortune. This wasn't the summer. The year that I ended up catching Tom Seaver in my front yard and then three times at his house. This must have been the second year that Bill and I did this. Seaver, if you remember, tried to make a comeback with the Mets in 87.
Yes, absolutely.
And it failed, but at the time he was doing a memorabilia deal with my father and coming over to the house like once a week to sign stuff. My dad would advertise in the trade magazines. Seaver would sign stuff. My dad would ship it back out, and they'd split the profit or whatever. So when the Mets asked him to try to make a comeback, he needed someone to pitch to. So he asked if I would catch him, and of course I'm like, yeah.
I'll only catch a Hall of Famer, you know, my father-in-law. No problem.
So I was explaining to Seaver about this, the micro league team and my all-time Mets team. And as you know, micro league was strictly an offensive game. There was no defensive accounting for anything. So, but Harrelson was not my shortstop because Frank Tavares had a year where he hit .279.
Sure.
And was, at that point, the most productive shortstop the Mets had ever had.
So who was your third baseman, by the way? Was it Howard Johnson?
It might have been Hojo, or there might have been a good Hubie Brooks year in there.
Oh, yeah, that's
true. I think Hojo's really good years didn't come until, like, 88.
Well, 87, so, I think he had a big year in 87, I think. But maybe maybe 89 might have been his first.
I can't remember what version of the game we were playing, if we had the 86 or the 87. So if it wasn't Hojo, it was probably Hubie Brooks.
Right, 84 probably.
Or it might have been, like, a Hubie and a Wayne Garrett platoon or something. Either way, it wasn't great.
third baseman in the Mets. That's
so I'm going through my lineup with Seaver, and I tell him that Frank Tavares is at shortstop. Now, you have to understand, Seaver loves Bud Harrelson, part because he was a great defensive shortstop and saved a lot of runs, and Seaver obviously appreciated him for everything that he did. So I say, and then I got Frank Tavares in short, and he says, no, you got to have Harrelson. And I said, well, Tom, there's really no defense involved. And, you know, Buddy's best year was like 235. Tavares at 279 stole 20. No, you got to have Harrelson. Well, I understand, Tom. No, you got to have Harrelson. Just put Harrelson. I mean, he was adamant that I had to put Harrelson in my Mike League team. So Simmons and I, we get down to, I mean, the summer is ending. I am like, it's the night before I'm driving to college the next morning, and we're at game 156, and Bill's got a six-game lead on me, and I win the last six games to split 81-81 for the 162 games.
Wow, that's amazing.
We had Hawk Harrelson was the offensive MVP. I think he hit like 38 or 39 home runs. And I think Seaver was the best pitcher of the bunch. Mm-hmm. Now, I had good pitching. You know, that's when you take the best Mets years from 62 to 87 or whatever it was, with Seaver and Kuzman and Matlack and Gooden. And, you know, you put together a pretty good pitching staff.
For sure, yeah.
So it was a lot of fun, but it was just pretty funny that we spent the entire summer and cranked out six games the last day to finish at 81 and 81.
That's fantastic. I love that. And you you went to college in Florida, is that correct?
Yes, Rollins College, which is near Orlando.
Gotcha. Wow. So that was probably a little bit better of a ride down, knowing you had not lost to Bill.
Yeah, I think, in fact, later that year, Bill came down to visit me, and we went to a spring training Red Sox game at Tinker Field in Orlando, which is right next to the Citrus Bowl.
Okay.
And, in fact, behind the right field fence of Tinker Field was the backside of the stands for the Citrus Bowl. So imagine, you know, a football stadium, how high up they go.
Yeah.
Well, it was like 15-3 or something going into the eighth inning. And I was like, Bill, come on. I got homework. I got whatever. You know, I got stuff I got to do. We don't need to sit around and watch any more of this Red Sox Twins whatever. And he was adamant about staying. And finally I just said, look, I've got the car. So if you want to walk back from here to Rollins, you're welcome. But I'm leaving. So he hops in the car begrudgingly. And, you know, and again, in those days, no highlights of spring training games. You just read about stuff in the next. The USA Today would have the little blurb on each team.
Right.
Well, after we had left, Sam Horn hit one about three-quarters of the way up the facade there of the of the Citrus Bowl stands. You know, Dan Shaughnessy said it was the longest ball he's ever hit, blah, 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 blah. So to this day, Bill's still mad at me that I dragged him away from seeing Sam Horn hit his 500-foot home run or whatever it would have been.
The decidedly not legendary Sam Horn.
That's yeah. Great.
So this is where we'll end part one of the Box Score Gus Ramsey interview. Be sure to check out part two, where we do a deep dive into MLB 12 The Show, as well as hit on another common love of ours, the state of our New York Mets. Thanks for listening to this episode of Box Score, brought to you by Games Radar. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes and give it a rating, too, while you're there. I'm your host, Richard Grisham. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Rich Grisham. Tweet me any thoughts, questions, or comments about this or future shows. And you can follow Gus Ramsey, too. His handle is Gus Ramsey. And also follow Games Radar at their handle, Games Radar. And be sure to read my weekly Box Score column each and every Thursday on the site. Every click counts. So until next time, this is Richard Grisham for Box Score.